Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
I haven't been in studio, even though we've talked.
For a long
time. For a couple weeks. Yeah.
I feel like you're like an imposter. Like, who are you?
I know. Who am I? I have no idea. I have no idea. You have a little boy's birthday in 2 days.
Believe me, he reminds me every minute. If I hear the word really rad robot one more time, that's like all he's obsessed with and focused on, and it's hilarious. So it's like every day it becomes like a different thing, but this robots is his thing lately. So my parents got him that. So of course I had to get one for Remy too, so they can play robots with each other. But
are they out here now, your parents?
No, they just sent it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they just
and are
sent
they
it.
Coming for the next weekend?
No, they're not coming next weekend. They're going to come. When are they going to come? December time, I think. But there's not. I realize with my boys, like, I don't think there's like an ounce of estrogen. Like, I think they are pure testosterone. Like, I was walking with them to school this morning, and like Remy's picking up a stick. He's like banging like London's backpack, and I'm like, yeah, they're just all boy. Like, it's
but
hilarious.
They're so loving to you.
They are.
They really are. So, they still have a heart. Even
and you know what's
boys.
Weird? Like, I was actually telling somebody today, like, I have a thing. This is going to sound like very like weird, but I mean it in like a cool way. I have a thing for like little boys. Like, I don't know. I just get them and like understand them. And today I went on a tour for private schools because I have to look for Remy. And this little boy was sort of like my host. He was in sixth grade. And I like fell in love with him. He was like the sweetest boy. And like I wrote a note and I was like, please give this to your mom. And it just talked about how kind and like articulate he was and how welcoming he was. And then like I was touring the classroom and I see him and he's like waving to me. We like, it's like sweet, sweet connection. So like I definitely was meant to have two boys for sure.
That's awesome.
So yeah, what's going on with you?
Had to get a new dryer.
I was wondering, did you text me a picture of that?
No.
Yes.
Oh, on purpose. I mean, on accident.
I was like, I think that's an accident, but maybe she's trying to get my opinion about her dryer. I don't know. I don't know what this is, but.
Well, you know the thing with stuff like that now,
yeah.
Appliances, is that there's a real excitement about all the modern technology stuff that comes along with it, but that also comes along with breakage that is almost impossible to fix or super expensive to fix. So we just went with a floor model, super simple, no bells and whistles, because when they break, they're really easy to fix.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I loved when we moved into our house, I was like obsessed with the washing machine. It was like so amazing. I said like in the contract, like I need that washing machine to stay if we're buying the house. Like I became very attached to it.
Did you get it?
Yeah. I love that thing. It's like a spaceship.
Oh.
It like I love it. I don't know.
How many
like,
times have the boys crawled in?
You know what? I think it's happened maybe once. But it had to happen at least once. At least.
And so, how's Moosey doing?
He's doing okay, actually. You know what? I walked him to school with the boys today and he did pretty well. So it comes and goes, you know, but he pees a lot. Like, and I'm, you know what's funny though? This is actually really funny. He'll pee in our shower and I'm like, what a fucking brilliant dog. Like if you're gonna pee anywhere, pee in the shower, easy cleanup. And he pooped one in the poops in the shower sometimes too, and I'm like, God, I love this dog. I just love him. Like he just knows, like, all right, I'll make it easy for them. I can't hold it, so I might as well just,
oh my gosh,
isn't that funny?
So funny. So you know, at Home Depot they have these holiday singing toy things that are
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, right, like little dogs or it's a little snowman or something like that, and they have to sing a song. So I buy these every year to torture the cats and my daughter, because my daughter, I'll play it for her 20 times. She says, Mom, I can't stand it. I can't stand it. I can't get that song out of my head. One of them was Jammin' in My Jammies on Christmas Day. Opened up my presents. Now it's time to play. That goes on.
Oh,
so now I got a little toy dog. It's like a terrier.
Okay.
And it goes, who let the dogs out?
Oh, my
so
God.
So I brought it home and I put it on the floor, and Prowler and Bob, they go up and sniff it. Then I turn it on and they both sort of like jump back. And then Prowler, bless him, he's so cute. He just lies down right next to it and just completely watches it like it's completely nothing. Didn't scare him.
Oh my God.
He was like oblivious to it. Like,
I love
it. I am better than you. You're a dog.
That would drive me to drink, by the way. Like that constant noise. Well,
something
noise,
should.
Yeah, that's if it's not my kids, might as well be that. But that like constant noise, like I would go crazy. I don't know. I don't like when people sing happy birthday to me on my birthday. I don't like loud, repetitive noises. So,
well, then I'm going to send you the video to torture you too.
Great. Set myself for that one.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So last week we had Maureen Healy on the emotionally healthy child, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of good tips and just like really simple and easy to use. And, you know, really.
Yeah. And we need it today more than ever.
Boy, do we.
Yeah.
Yes. So did you pull any tricks out of it for your boys?
I think my boys need many, many tricks aside from this. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe some magic. Maybe we need a magician on here. Trade my children. So let's talk about today.
Yes.
Very excited for our guest today. So you want me to do the...
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So we have Anne Grant, who she's a lawyer and began her career as a corporate litigator specializing in unfair business practices and consumer fraud. After her own divorce, she created her own firm focusing on family law and a holistic approach to this life transition. She lives in Manhattan Beach, and her website is www.thedivorcehacker.com.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you.
How did you come up with the divorce hacker? That's so ingenious. I love it.
Well, actually, I was also developing an app to implement the tools in the book to make it easier for women to understand how to not only end a marriage, but start a new life. And so I was looking for a book title that could also be used for the app that hadn't been used before. And that is how I came up with Divorce Hacker.
I love it. It's great. And I love the cover. It's just fabulous.
So I
think, thank you.
I think this is so needed. And I'm curious, like, obviously you felt the same way, but I'm even personally, like, I have a friend who's going through a divorce, and there's just so much that you obviously don't think about until it happens. And so I think it's so brilliant that, you know, you have this guide out there. So were you noticing the same in your practice? It was like, oh my God, there's so much that people don't know and they kind of need this manual to get by.
Yeah, actually what happened was when I went through my divorce, I was really looking for guidance. I wasn't a divorce lawyer at that time. I was a corporate litigator. But although I'm an attorney, I still felt overwhelmed by all the things that had to be dealt with that I was facing for the first time. And there were no books out there that provided what I was looking for. A book like What to Expect When You're Expecting, with solutions and answers to all those tricky questions, but for divorce. And so it struck me that a book like that needed to be written to provide comprehensive guidance about the legal process and all the other things that you have to deal with. I find women coming into my office often seek advice from their friends and relatives, but your Aunt Martha, who got divorced in 1983 in New York, is not the best resource for a woman facing divorce today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I wrote the book.
I was curious, if this is an off question, but do you have any statistics, and you may not, so no worries, on who of the genders tends to ask for a divorce more often? Is it more men that file and want it, or more women, or have no idea?
It's women. I think it's about 80% of divorces are filed by women. And I do find in my practice that for whatever reason, I touch on this in the book, men seem to be more conflict averse. And so they will typically act out in a marriage before they will file. This is a generalization, but it's proven to be true. And it shows up in all kinds of ways. They might have an extramarital affair or engage in internet porn or any number of other activities, kind of extramarital activities, I guess you could call them, rather than dealing with the issue and filing. And women are typically the ones that will, as I like to say, pull the trigger to end the marriage when it becomes clear that they need to do so.
And is it true that the divorce rate is going down, or what's the deal with that?
So it is true that the divorce rate is trending down, and that's probably because fewer people, particularly millennials, are getting married. Mm. But the divorce rate in the United States for people that are 50 and older has actually doubled since 1990.
Oh my God.
And as the American population steadily ages, what we call gray divorces will keep rising. It's anticipated that by 2030, approximately 800,000 divorces for women over, or I'm sorry, for people over the age of 50 will occur each year.
Mm. What are the most common reasons these days for people getting divorced? Is it infidelity? Is it financial fraud? Just losing interest in one another? Children grow up and the empty nest and the midlife crisis. I don't know. I'm just throwing everything out, not letting you answer. Please answer. Sorry.
So all of the above. But it is interesting to note what I've noticed anecdotally and what the research bears out is that most women will overlook a single instance of infidelity. But typically what brings them into my office is what I call financial infidelity. Mm. So often where you find that a spouse has been disloyal, you will also find as you dig deeper that there are any number of financial shenanigans going on, from moving money to various accounts, some of them offshore sometimes, to trying to jerry-rig when they're going to get their retirement benefits. And I have a whole host of stories that I allude to and talk about in the book about those kinds of issues that do come up.
Would that be because that man is already contemplating filing for divorce and wants to prevent being, what, quote-unquote, financially devastated?
I think so. I can tell you a story of one client. As an example, she was a Saturday morning and she was working at her computer, and her husband tapped her on the shoulder and said, I'm leaving now. And she thought he was either headed to the gym or down the street to get some bagels. And then he told her that she should retain counsel. Mm. So when she came into my office, what she told me was that her husband had been fired from his very high-paying job, where he was the CFO of a company. And actually what we found out after digging around a bit was that he had taken an early retirement, and the day after he tapped her on the shoulder and walked out the door, he received over $1.5 million in a payout of some of his benefits. And his lawyer then claimed that that was his separate property because they had separated the previous day.
Whoa.
And, of course, we were able to establish that, in fact, the money had been earned prior to the day he left. Mm. And she was entitled to her community property share. But nevertheless, you know, that was the attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see that sort of thing happen more often than I'd like to see.
It's so diabolical and unkind. You'd think that people who spent, you know, years of their lives together would want to be kinder to each other when parting, but it's so not true, is it?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are those evolved couples who are able to resolve their differences amicably, split their assets, and move on with their lives. And of course, that's the goal. But sadly, that's not always reality. I had one instance where a gal came to me and she'd been served with divorce papers. It was a lengthy marriage. They'd been married for about 16 years. And during the course of representing her, she saw on Facebook that his proclaimed girlfriend actually was his wife, that he had gone off to South America and had another wife.
Oh my God.
So, and he'd been claiming the traveling down there on his tax returns as business travel. She thought he was traveling for business, but he'd actually set up another family. So, I mean, that sort of thing is not a common occurrence, but it's surprising the extent to which some people will go to hide things. And in fact, he did all that while they were in mediation to end their marriage amicably. I say that with air quotes. And while they were in marriage counseling. So he was really using counseling and the idea of going through mediation as a ruse to keep her from figuring out where he was moving assets and what he was up to.
So we are talking with Anne Grant. She is the author of The Divorce Hacker's Guide to Untying the Knot. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about children, because I know that complicates divorce so much. And so what are the latest studies saying as far as should children stay in the home and you kind of try to work it out, but you're fighting as parents? Is it better if they are raised in, you know, separate houses? What's that story?
Such a good question. So the psychological experts from the 70s long touted the idea that children fared better in an unhappy home than a broken one. And I was just talking to a therapist earlier in the week who told me that, you know, this was the common thought pattern until very recently, that therapists were typically advising their clients it's better to stay together and stick it out than to be divorced. So what's happened, though, is there is a new study that's come out, and it's shown that combative relationships, as well as cold and contemptuous ones, are actually oftentimes more harmful to children than breakups. And the key concept here is stability. So I actually experienced this firsthand. My children were relatively young when I divorced, 7 and 11. And what I experienced, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, was that I was surprised to find that the kids did a whole lot better once I ended a dysfunctional marriage than beforehand. And so I did some of my own research and was absolutely convinced that if you're stable and grounded, you can provide a perfectly good home life for your children. And that staying in a bad marriage, which I did for a couple of years, solely for the purpose of trying to do the best thing for the family, isn't always the best thing for the kids. It's a really important myth that we need to debunk.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Anne, because that research used to piss me off so much because intuitively it's so wrong. I grew up in a family, my parents were miserably unhappy, and it trickled down like crazy. There was no way to hide it. You know, they had their moments, obviously. They loved each other and they had stuff, but they could not. They were the Bickersons and a half. And it just always was like, what are you saying? Do you stay together? What are your children learning then about love, about relationship, about kindness, about how respect, all those things that are so crucial? So if you can't demonstrate that in a united home, then go have alternate partners where you can so they get to see that. So I'm so glad
that there's
now studies that actually support that, because that really, really makes good sense. Yeah.
Well, I think also things have changed in the sense that a lot of kids stay in the home now and the parents leave. So the kids will kind of stay and then the parents will maybe get, like, I know of couples who they have kind of one apartment, and then so the parent stays with the kids for one time and the other parent goes in the vacant apartment. And then that way the kids aren't shuffled back and forth, which I bet makes a difference.
I think that can work okay, Kelly, for a little while. But when people do unite with somebody else, that becomes really challenging. So it, you know, kind of depends on the couple. But Anne, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's called, I think the term is nesting. And I have the same feelings about that that you do. It sounds really great, like a great idea, but in practice, it can be problematic. I represented a client where they were doing that. They were each rotating in and out of the house, and the kids were staying put.
Okay.
And it sounded like a great plan. But what happened is once he began seeing someone else, and when the wife rotated in, she saw the signs of that, she lost her mind. I mean, the police had to be called, and it was really a difficult situation. So while it's one of those things that sounds great, but in practice, it can be difficult to implement.
Makes sense.
Yeah. I think if people are really amicable and they really truly respect each other's decision to move on, mm-hmm. and I think then it can work when everybody's comfortable with other partners.
Right.
You know, then I think that and then many couples can do that and have that. But I also think it's important for people to remember that divorce is a change. It doesn't have to be a traumatic change unless the parents make it as such. Mm-hmm. So, and change builds resiliency in children.
Yeah.
So as long as the children's lives don't change too dramatically one way or the other mm-hmm. by the separation, mm-hmm. then they usually fare fairly well if the yeah. parents do not use the children as pawns between each other, right? I think that, again, intuitively just makes sense.
That's the key. So you're absolutely right. Children are very resilient. They're also like little sponges. So, you know, they pick up on things that most adults are not aware that they're tuning into. Mm-hmm. So the key thing I have found is that children want to know that they're safe.
Yeah.
That's really, when it comes down to it, their primary concern, that they're safe and loved. Mm-hmm. So as long as they feel safe and loved by both parents, or even just one good, solid parent, they're going to be okay. The problem is when the parents begin to use the children as pawns. And this happens far too often right. in divorce. And when it does, the consequences are tragic. And so I do go into quite great detail about the importance of not doing that and making certain that you're taking the high road, even if your spouse isn't, or your ex-spouse, as you're moving through and once the divorce mm-hmm. is completed.
So what happens if you are pretty level-headed? I imagine this happens quite often. And your spouse or ex-spouse is not, and you're dealing with either a narcissist or somebody who just has so much rage and anger. How do you kind of deal with that when you can kind of control your own actions but can't control your spouse's?
So the key to dealing with a narcissistic spouse, and I write about this at length because it seems like I tend to encounter that quite a bit, is to set really good boundaries. The problem with the narcissist is that they just don't have the capacity to empathize. And so they will do all kinds of things that are counterproductive and even hurtful to you and the children with complete disregard for how it's impacting you and the children and the collateral consequences of their actions. So the only thing that works with the narcissist is to establish firm boundaries, and if they're violating them by texting you or emailing you or constantly calling and harassing you, then you need to get your lawyer involved and take appropriate steps, because reasoning with the narcissist doesn't work. They don't operate like healthy human beings operate, and particularly not when they're under stress. So they will take advantage of your efforts to try to be reasonable and work things out in an amicable way. So you may have to tell them that, you know, you will not communicate with them any further unless the communication is respectful and doesn't cross your boundaries, and that you'll only communicate with them through your attorney if they really will not cease the bullying.
And as just a little side note on that, be prepared, though, for the bullying to escalate temporarily, because they do not like to have boundaries set. And mm-hmm. they generally, if you've tried to set them in the past and you've reneged on them, then they will work even harder, like a temper tantruming child, to get the candy and to get what they want. So you have to be prepared to really be consistently setting those boundaries and not cave. And then eventually the bullying will subside, at least to some degree. It's hard.
It's so hard.
They get crushed.
Yeah.
It's so challenging.
It's a good point. And I think often what I see when a person comes in and they're married to a narcissist, and this is something you can probably speak to more fully, but often it's a codependent relationship. And so there's often a tendency to, like you just suggested, set a boundary and then cave, you know, and that's the pattern, that's the dance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's really important to not only have good representation in your divorce, but for anyone, and particularly a person in that situation, it's important to have a good support system and probably a good therapist who can help you establish appropriate boundaries and then stick to them.
I was just going to say, as therapists, you know, Kelly and I probably each, we never really talked about this, have some set of criteria when we're working with a couple in therapy as mm-hmm. to, you know, when it might be wise to help them call it quits.
I was just going to say that.
Stay yeah. together. So I'd be curious to hear your point of view about what, from a lawyer's point of view, and just a person who's experienced that, when do you call it quits?
It's a really good question. So what I have found is that many women think they can change their spouse, or that a marital counselor or therapist or even a religious advisor will bring him or her around and get that person to cease their extramarital activities, for example, which is often happening in these situations. And having been taught to be patient and carry on, women in particular often are waiting for their husbands to come around. But there's a very real and present danger to waiting. I've seen many cases, and I've talked about one already, where women are in marriage therapy with their husbands for years, mm-hmm. and their husbands are pretending to have an intention to mend things, but they're actually secretly carrying on an affair and or hiding assets.
Mm-hmm.
And women really need to understand the signs to look out for and take proactive steps to protect themselves. And so I do provide concrete guidance in the book about specific steps to take to avoid that trap.
Can you give us maybe two or three signs that you outline in the book, and then one or two steps?
Sure. So, you know, if your husband is completely disconnected, if you're living separate lives, a lot of the women that come in as we dig into the details of what's been going on, I see this story play out time and again where they're raising children.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get the kids launched, you know, headed out the door to college or whatever their next steps will be. And in the meantime, the husband and wife have grown distant and are just no longer connected at all. So if that's the case, oftentimes the husband's traveling a lot. I see a lot of instances where the wife reports, oh, yeah, you know, he was gone for 7 months on business at this one location. He came back briefly and then was gone again. I think that, you know, those are all signs that, you know, there's a real disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I also find often women come in and as they're working with me, they either find out through, you know, social media or looking on the computer or the phone, the husband's cell phone, that he's having an affair. And they're usually just shocked. And yet when we talk about it and I learn that, you know, they haven't had sex for years, I'm often puzzled that they're shocked.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are sort of common sense red flags, but you would be surprised at how many women, I think I would call it willful blindness. That's a term that's used in the legal community, not typically in divorces, but it certainly applies here. We're sort of intentionally blind to what's going on and staying in a state of denial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they
right.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Wow.
So the steps that I recommend that a woman should take before she files, and certainly really are good to take at any point in time, and I think it actually could lead to a better marriage, is to be financially savvy. So knowing where the money is so that you're not surprised and where it's going. The importance of that can't be overstated. And I think even in healthy marriages, certainly communication about finances is important. I think it's one of the leading causes, as I've mentioned before, of divorce. So what I recommend is that women have a bank account in their own name, and that they set aside money for living expenses and should they need to hire an attorney. And to stress the importance of this, I'll tell you about a gal who came to me. Her husband was the assistant head coach of one of Los Angeles's professional sports teams. And the team was at an away set of games, so he was traveling with the team. But unbeknownst to her, while she and the kids were out to dinner one night, he came back early. He stole the teenage son's Jeep. He filled it with his belongings, and he took off and also cleaned out the joint bank account, took out several hundred thousand dollars, and left her with $238. And then he sent her a text and said he did it so she couldn't hire a lawyer. Now, we were able to go to court and get the money returned, but not without her experiencing a great deal of panic. So... And that's not an isolated story.
Right.
That happens. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important for women to actually set aside some money. You never know what could happen, and it's just a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then check your credit score.
Okay.
You really do need to build your own credit. There are a few numbers in life that matter as much as your to your financial outlook and your well-being as your credit score. So it's important for you to know what your credit score is and work to improve it if it's not in the good range. And then I also suggest that you open two credit cards in your own name, and you need to be the primary cardholder on these cards if you possibly can. Because if you have a wallet full of credit cards and your husband's the primary card holder,
mm-hmm.
He can cancel those cards without your permission.
Mm-hmm.
Or likewise, if he were to pass away and you don't have your own credit, it becomes very difficult to establish it. So it's just a good idea to do that. And then I suggest that women gather and copy documentation for all assets, bank accounts, investments, and retirement plans, even if they're in your spouse's name. A lot of women will come in and say, oh, well, my husband has a pension or he has a retirement account. But anything earned or acquired during the course of the marriage in a community property state is half yours.
Mm.
So it's not his pension. It's also your pension. So make a copy of all of those statements and familiarize yourself with them.
Thank you. You know, I know your book is geared mostly toward women, but I know we have a lot of male listeners also, and I just want to say that this can happen in both directions. I have a client whose ex-wife had kidnapped their child, went to Europe, cleaned out the bank account, and he had to go through the whole Hague Treaty and
wow.
all this sort of thing, and ultimately decided not to bring her back because the alienation was so severe.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just a trusting, unsuspecting guy who just figured they were having trouble. And, you know, when he separated and thought she would totally understand that
yeah.
they would be getting divorced because she's the one who, like, would pick on him every day, shaming him, telling him what a slob he was, yada, yada, yada,
mm-hmm.
self-esteem in the toilet. It's like, fine, be rid of me then.
Right.
I get it. I'm demoralized. I understand it, but I'm a great dad. So I just think that men need to also be careful.
Yeah.
There's a lot of men who also are stay-at-home dads who,
yes.
who, you know, run the household, and the moms are in power sometimes. So it's
mm-hmm.
this is not just gender-specific.
You're so right. And I've always thought that the book would be the best hand guide for a man going through divorce because it's the playbook.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But yes, to your point, the reason I wrote the book for women is because I was just seeing an inordinate number of women coming into my practice that were just terribly unprepared and didn't know, for example, where any of the money was. And they were at a tremendous disadvantage in that regard.
Sure.
So it felt like there was a great need to reach out to them, and a book like this had not been written. But it does certainly apply equally to both sides of the table, for sure.
I have a question about if your spouse is psychologically unwell? Because I imagine, I know we talked a little bit about narcissism, but I mean, what are the steps to take if you really feel like your spouse is not mentally there? I mean,
serious depression or anxiety, post-traumatic stress. Yeah, like all how do things.
You, I know that can cost a lot of money, or like, how does that work if you need a psychological evaluation for your spouse or you're requesting one?
It's a good question. So, a psychological evaluation can be conducted, particularly if there are children, minor children involved, and it is ordered by the court unless the parties agree to do it. And you can either hire a private individual, someone who has qualifications as a mental health professional, for example, and who has trained in conducting psychological evaluations, to go through the process with the parties. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes the court will appoint a psychological evaluation, and if the parties don't have the resources to pay for a private evaluation, they have individuals that work through the court system who can undertake an evaluation. And that's the typical methodology that is used. Mm-hmm. Where those kinds of allegations are being made, and they're particularly relevant where custody issues arise.
Mm-hmm. There's another, I work in the world of addiction a lot and family work and such, and I think it's also valuable. A lot of people deal with a situation where they are divorcing a spouse who may be in recovery or in relapse, and as part of the divorce orders, there's drug testing that mm-hmm. has to be done. And I think it's important. A lot of spouses will say, well, you know, he's been clean for a long time, so I don't need to do that, and I don't want to rock the boat. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really, really important. It's a really nice tool where you don't have to be reading the signs of whether somebody is back to using or not, but you get to actually see just the evidence, although mm-hmm. people can fake drug tests. But, right. but I would suggest to people, if you're in that situation, that you actually follow through. You know, it's just checks and balances.
It's very smart, because I think you're right. It's like they get very stuck and like, oh well, he's been sober, it's not a problem, or right. And yeah, it's fascinating. It's a great piece of advice.
I see that happen. Yeah, I see that happen a lot. And again, oftentimes I think when one spouse has an addiction, the other spouse, it's developed into sort of a codependent relationship.
Sure.
And so yeah, when they're doing well, when they're sober, then sometimes the spouse will fall into that pattern of, oh, everything's fine. He or she's really showing up, really great with the kids. And then they don't want to push the issue. But I think that having drug testing done in those situations can be beneficial to everyone, including the party that that has the issue, because it gives them incentive to be sober so that they can participate fully with the children.
That's a great point.
Sort of, again, a little bit off topic, maybe not as important as some of the other things we've been talking about, but, you know, in a lot of custody arrangements with children and picking schedules and things like that, you know, the old traditional, either, you know, every other weekend and mm-hmm. a day or two during the week. Can you speak to that versus some of the more modern, more out of the box ways of people sharing custody in maybe more some more amicable situations? And holidays.
Sure.
That's a big one, too. Mm-hmm. Holidays and vacation and times. Holidays and vacation times.
Right. So what we're finding here in the courts in Southern California is that the judges are much more apt to order a 50-50 parenting plan. And what that is, it means that the mom and the dad share physical custody of the children. And it used to be in the olden days, not even that long ago, that more of a traditional timeshare was typically awarded. And often the mom would have the kids for the lion's share of the time, and the dad would have the children on alternating weekends and one time during the week. But what I'm seeing is that if the often the dad, talking about the dad here, if he's willing to participate more fully with the children and adjust his schedule, courts are quite willing to order that the parents will have each of the parents will have the children half the time. So what do those plans look like when that happens? So for younger children, typically courts don't want them to be away from either parent or the parent that they're used to being with most of the time, which is often the mom, for an extended period of time. So they'll order what's called a 2-2-3 schedule. And I have these mapped out in the book so you can see graphically what they look like, because that's kind of easier than trying to explain it. But essentially, it's 2 days on, and then 2 days with the other parent, and then 2 days back, and then three, alternating. And it's a lot of switching back and forth, which is challenging if you're, you know, schlepping things like diaper bags and such back and forth. But the idea there is that way the child isn't away from either parent for too long a period of time. Mm-hmm. And then when kids get to be school age, oftentimes you'll see a 2-2-5-5 plan go into place. And that is just what it sounds like, 2 days with one parent and then alternating two with the other, five and then five. This has less back and forth. So most parents like that better, I've found. And it also, when you look at it graphically laid out, what it does is it has you alternating weekends. And most parents like that also because it gives them weekend time with the child. And as kids get older, once they're teenagers, or even sometimes preteens, they'll do well with a 1 week on, 1 week off. Mm. And that then has them shuffling back and forth less. Mm-hmm. And sometimes parents then also will alternate the weekends in addition to that. But what I found is the kid, I found this in my own situation and with my clients, is that as the children get older, they have more and more things going of their own with their friends, and more activities that they're involved in, whether it's sports or what have you. And so as they get older, it's important to be flexible and accommodate the kids' schedule so that they can, you know, grow into independent adults.
And I love that you're mentioning about younger children versus older children, because like in my case, my daughter's father and I separated when she was 7 months old. And, you know, knowing about developmental psychology and attachment, it was really important to me that he felt like he could see her every day. So while it wasn't my ideal, he would come over in the morning, he'd come over in the evening, so she would continue to have that attachment. And then we would share time on the weekends. And if he had her on the weekends, I'd go visit over there. And if I had her on the weekend, he'd come visit. So there was never more than maybe one day that went by for at least the 2 years where she didn't see both of us.
Wow.
Yeah. So it took a lot of sacrifice or compromise, but I think it was really worth it because she really developed a very solid, close attachment to both of us. And then what's so curious and cute about it is when she was a teenager and she really had the freedom to pick and choose, she just kept the same. We had shifted along the way what made sense, but she always went there on Tuesday nights. And she you got stuff going on here. No, it's dad's night. And it was really cute. But
she liked the structure.
Anyway, yeah, but so much good information. And I guess for one other piece to that, what you were saying is that it's good for people to think more long term when they're organizing their custody arrangement. Because I think sometimes people are short-sighted and they think only about the next 3 years or 5 years. But a lot of things can change, like if you get remarried and then you have other children and all those things, I think, are important for people like you. And I'm sure you do this because you're so sophisticated in this area about, you know, really helping people think through this in the long run and not just impulsively in the short run.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say you were extremely enlightened co-parents. And that really shows, it's reflected in what you said about your daughter. And how even once she got older and was at a point where she could make the choice, continued with the plan so she would see her dad. And my son actually does the same thing Tuesday and Thursday nights. He organizes his schedule so he can spend time with his father. And I think you know, I just don't think we can do a greater service than that for our children in terms of giving them a solid foundation. Mm-hmm. And then your second point about thinking long term. Yeah. So oftentimes when parents are going through their disillusion and they're working out their plan, they're only looking at what's happening tomorrow mm-hmm. or today. And they're not thinking about what's going to happen long term, because things are really going to shift and change between when a child is 7 months old or 7 years old and when they're 17. And you don't want to have to rush back to court every year or every 6 months to get court orders to change your schedule. I have a couple of clients like that, and I can tell you the only person that benefits when that happens is the lawyer who bills by the hour.
Right.
So it doesn't benefit either the parties or typically the children. So you want to, what I try to do is structure in a provision in the agreement, the settlement agreement, that the parties will meet and confer and or meet with a mediator in the future should disputes about the parenting plan arise, rather than just rushing directly into court.
So, Anne, we are out of time. You are fantastic. You're so articulate. You explain things so beautifully.
Yes.
I was thinking, like, my marriage is good, but man, if I ever get a divorce, I'm going to you. I mean, like, you're really good. So thank you so much. Again, we've been talking with Anne Grant. She is the author of The Divorce Hacker's Guide to Untying the Knot. So, and where can people find you again? Give us the website one more time. Is it just divorcehackers.com?
Thedivorcehacker.com.
Perfect.
Yes, I concur with exactly what Kelly said and double it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much. You were a wonderful guest. Really appreciate it.
You got it. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, all right. So next week we have Dr. Seda. She's going to talk about desire. So now it's like we go from divorce to like
desire,
getting back in the sack. So I love the dichotomy.
All right.
All right. See you next week.
Love y'all. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.